Ms. Hodge?
Yes, may I proceed?
Please proceed, if you're
ready. Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Senior Assistant Attorney General Pat Hodge, and I represent the appellants in this case, who include Cindy Gillespie, the Secretary of the Arkansas Department of Human Services. Your Honors, at the heart of this case is the appellee's contention that DHS appellants violate their due process rights because Arkansas's AR Choices Medicaid waiver program lacks perfection. But perfection is not a constitutional standard and is not required. The imperfections that appellees maintain violate the due process clause are an allegation that a fraction of AR Choices beneficiaries experienced an inadvertent but temporary interruption in their benefits while waiting an administrative appeal. And second, they advocate for a perfect notice of reduction in benefits, so perfect in its form that one like it has never been recognized by the U.S. Supreme Court or a decision out of this circuit.
Well, counsel, this is Judge Smith. Whether they're seeking perfection, I think, is not something we're empowered to look at. What we're wanting to see is if it meets the standard of due process under the federal Constitution, which requires a reasonable opportunity of notice and hearing. And the question is, has the system that's been produced in Arkansas and that operates in Arkansas, does it operate in such a way that people are deprived of rights guaranteed under the federal Constitution without a prior notice and a reasonable opportunity to contest? That's what we're actually trying to decide. And the problem is, not only has this happened before, but the concern is, can this continue to happen under this same system? And so particularly with respect to Elder, for instance, I don't know what's transpired since the original facts of the case, but it seems the allegation is that there's a possibility that the deprivation she suffered was remedied promptly because of the intervention of counsel. And that same potential could occur again. And the individuals who are the plaintiffs in this case are extremely vulnerable individuals receiving care for receiving benefits for daily care, and being deprived of those benefits for even brief periods of time could have very significant impacts upon their well-being. So if you would address what the state views as its attempt to avoid individuals not having notice prior to termination of their benefits, or having an opportunity to respond to termination before it occurs.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think Your Honor has raised three distinct issues. One, there is not a question of whether or not any appellee in this case has ever received notice. That's a separate legal issue that I will address. I'll dovetail to the specific question in this case with respect to Dearmore was whether or not the notice she received apprised her that she was undergoing a reduction in benefits. And the answer to that question is yes. Your Honor, ask about...
Does the notification require more than just a notice that you are having your benefits reduced? Doesn't it also require an explanation as to why? And if so, I couldn't read those numbers on the back of that notification and have any clue as to how that matrix worked out to get to the answer. It didn't really tell me why the reduction took place. And is that a problem?
It's not a problem, and let me take two steps back, if I may, and answer the question this way and do this. The legal issue in this case that entitles DHS officials to a judgment in their favor is one of both qualified immunity and sovereign immunity. And I want to principally deal with qualified immunity in this case in light of the Supreme Court's most recent decisions in Rivas versus Cortes Luna and City of Tahlequah, Oklahoma versus Bond, because those cases read together establish three legal principles that guide this court's decisions before we even get to those questions in determining whether or not qualified immunity applies. And number one is that the appellees have the burden of identifying for this court United States Supreme Court precedent that places the questions that your honors are asking beyond dispute. Those cases have to come directly from the Supreme Court in order to establish 1983 liability. Otherwise, they aren't clearly established. And the facts from those cases, if appellees ever identified them, have to be so specific, factually similar, and specific in context that it is beyond dispute that any appellant in this case would have known that a temporary interruption in benefits violates the due process clause, or that that task and hour spreadsheet was insufficient to apprise Ms. Dearmore, for example, that her benefits were being reduced from 143 hours to 103 hours. And, Your Honor, there is not a single case cited by the appellants that put these two questions beyond dispute. And so qualified immunity bars this action against all individual capacity defendants, both for the alleged systematic temporary interruptions and for the specific notice provision. The two U.S. Supreme Court cases that have been identified for the court are Goldberg versus Kelly and O'Bannon, and neither of those cases deal factually with the two legal issues here, and that is whether or not if there are hiccups along the way, there is no dispute that DHS provides administrative appeals for AR Choices benefits. The issue is whether or not six interruptions since January of 2019 constitutes a systematic deficiency of a constitutional magnitude. And there is no United States Supreme Court decision out there that said DHS appellants in either their official or individual capacity violate due process when their systems aren't running perfectly. And that is why I started the argument the way I did, respectfully, Judge Smith, and that is the legal question. Goldberg's decision is markedly distinguishable because their New York's express policy was to interrupt the benefits intentionally after a preliminary review and restore the benefits only after the administrative appeals process. That's not the case here. And with respect to whether or not an allegation of systematic deficiencies on their own could ever constitute a due process violation, the United States Supreme Court's decision in Rizzo versus Good says no. There, the appellees raised the issue of whether or not systematic deficiencies in the citizen complaint process regarding police brutality could ever give rise to a constitutional violation and award and require prospective injunctive relief. And there the Supreme Court said no, that the appellees had to identify a specific and deliberate plan for the purpose of violating the appellees' constitutional rights. Otherwise, they weren't entitled to prospective injunctive relief. So here, the individual capacity appellants are entitled to qualified immunity because there simply are no cases that put them on notice that these errors would subject them to liability under 1983. I think it's important to note that both sides have identified cases from all over the country, Sixth Circuit, Ninth Circuit, Alaska, Washington, and all of those cases take different views and have different analysis about what's required for either a due process hearing or a notice. All of them certainly recognize, in general, a due process right, but the Supreme Court in Bond has admonished circuit courts that you can't identify the constitutional right at a very general level. That is why the specificity requirement is so important. And since there are no cases specifically dealing with a task and hour spreadsheet like the one DHS uses, or this allegation of systematic deficiencies, then sovereign immunity and qualified immunity both bar this case. I do want to note that the single case that appellees highlight from the Sixth Circuit that comes close to approaching an allegation of systematic deficiency is too dissimilar to have any precedential value in this case. That's the Cahoo case. There, the error rate was 93%. Here, the error rate is at most 30 over a four-year period, and at best six over a two-year period, a 1% error rate. And so certainly there are no cases that indicate that a 1% error rate constitutes a due process violation. Really, at best, the complaint raises negligence. But gross negligence has never been sufficient to satisfy a constitutional violation. You know, this is exactly the type of case with respect to qualified immunity that qualified immunity is designed to protect in issues of gray areas where there is no allegation that there was an intentional violation of the law, then public officials are not are given leeway to make the best judgments that they can make with the facts presented to them. To answer your question, Judge Smith, about whether or not Ms. Elder faces some future harm, that goes directly to Article III standing. And this court's decision in Webb versus Smith, which is cited in the brief, says the answer to that question doesn't, you know, establish liability in this case. This court would have to undergo at least five levels of speculation in order to determine whether or not, or to conclude that Ms. Elder is at risk of an immediate future risk of harm. And this court has said both in Frost and Webb that you won't engage in that speculation.
Counsel, I think you're very accurate on the law. The only concern is because the system seems to be largely automated and that the periodic review comes up, I think it's annually, that if the system operates as it has in the past, the potential or possibility or likelihood of repetition is still there. What gives assurance that this occurrence is not likely to recur?
There are two things that give this court assurance. One, you still would have to engage in some speculation. You have to speculate that in a year the system will be the same automated system, that in a year that Ms. Elder would be eligible for the system, that in a year she would be assessed and have an adverse action, and that in a year she would seek an appeal, and that in a year her benefits would be temporarily interrupted. You don't have those questions answered in the complaint. You have to speculate, and that's why there's no Article III standing. But equally important...
Has the government put something in the record to indicate that there are differences that would make recurrence either impossible or improbable?
I mean, the response that I just gave demonstrates that the record doesn't support you. The law says if you have to speculate to get there, then appellees haven't met their Article III standing requirement. The second issue, and I see I'm into my rebuttal time... I'm sorry, Judge.
Judge Erickson has a question.
But you're saying that the fact that the program is unchanged and it has the 10-day parameter and it is apparently unchanged, that it would still be speculative to say that program could systematically then create the same issue over and over again.
What I'm saying is what is speculative is whether or not Ms. Elder would actually be a part of the program, whether she would experience an adverse action, and whether upon experiencing that adverse action, she would suffer a temporary interruption in her benefits. Hundreds of other beneficiaries have not suffered. You know, that the complaint makes a point that there have been hundreds of administrative appeals since 2019, but they have only brought forward 30 in 4 years or six in 2 years. And so the court can conclude that this is not a guarantee. The other thing that we mentioned in our reply brief, because the appellees point to certain policy manuals in their complaint and in their briefing, that the current policy manual indicates that all DHS clients, including those receiving AR Choices benefits, will automatically have benefits continued through the end of the administrative appeals process. And so there is no likelihood that she would face, she or any other appellee would face inadvertent interruption in her benefits. Your Honors, I am out of time. I ran into my rebuttal answering Your Honor's questions. I would be happy to continue answering questions because I'm not sure, Judge Smith, if I got to answer all of the points you asked at the beginning of the presentation.
You've answered my questions and I appreciate it. We asked you quite a few questions. Even though your time's expired, after the appellee's response, the court will accord you a minute to supply rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate it.
All right.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Mr. DeLeban.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Kevin DeLeban. I work for Legal Aid of Arkansas and represent the appellees. I wanted to acknowledge my co-counsel on the brief, Mr. Hawkins, who's likely in the public listening in. Your Honor, there's many things to address. I think first is the qualified immunity standard that the state puts forward is totally inappropriate and overly specific. Of course, the two cases that the state cited in their reply brief, which were not in their initial brief and we didn't have a chance to respond to, are Fourth Amendment cases. And the Supreme Court's been clear that in the Fourth Amendment context, specificity is especially important because of the nature of the decisions that law enforcement officials have to make in the moment. Of course, this situation features none of that sort of in-the-moment fluidity. These are calculated, deliberate policy choices that have been made over the span of several years. And so that level of specificity isn't required. Even so, this court said in Bonner, which was quoted in our brief, that of course qualified immunity can be defeated in novel factual circumstances. And similarly, this circuit has said that general constitutional rules already identified in decisional law that apply with obvious clarity to the specific conduct can be sufficient to overcome qualified immunity. Your Honors, that was not cited in my brief. It is Shackleton versus Eichenberger, 677 F3D 361, quoting from various Supreme Court cases, including Hope v. Pelzer and Taylor v. Riojas. The main point, of course, is that over-specificity is not required here. You have the generally established constitutional due process principle that notice must be adequate. Everybody who's opined on this notes that notice must explain in plain informative language, it must be complete, all of these things, and the notice here is so obviously deficient that it doesn't rise to those standards. The notice has to explain decisions with respect to the process that the state uses. The state uses two components. One is setting an individual service budget, and the second is using that task and hour spreadsheet that was referred to before. There is nothing in the notice that talks about how you get at the budget or how the budget plays into the ultimate decision to reduce Ms. Dearmore's hours. It's totally absent from the notice. And then, of course, there's nothing that explains how the budget and the task and hour standards work together to arrive at the reduction in Ms. Dearmore's hours. And that's particularly noteworthy because for several years, the state has said Ms. Dearmore is entitled to 143 hours per month of care. And now it's saying she's entitled to 103. So after determining for several years that you're entitled to one level, what justifies the reduction? And there's nothing in the notice that explains that with reference to the system that DHS is using. So there's no level of specificity under which that notice is acceptable. Even so, there are all the cases in the Medicaid home and community-based care context that Ms. Hodge referred to and that are referred to in the briefs that all explain essentially that no matter whatever system you're using, you have to explain it. And so I think the notice is so obviously deficient that there's no question, there's no level of specificity under which qualified immunity would be appropriate.
Would you address Ms. Hodge's concern that the system overall is functioning at a high level of adequacy, and that there are relatively a small percentage of cases like the appellants that resulted in any reduction in benefits and none that haven't been remedied.
Certainly, Your Honor. The state is misleading. They use this 1% figure. That's misleading. What they're doing is taking the 30 or 40 cases that Legal Aid has identified in the complaint, and they're saying that those are all the cases in 4 or 5 years that have ever had this problem out of all the appeals that are there. Now, that's funny math, of course, because DHS itself doesn't keep statistics on the error rates or the number of people who receive continuing benefits when they timely appeal. They're just taking what we've alleged to be a proxy for everything, and that's not appropriate. We haven't said that we have that level of knowledge. So that's misleading. The other reason it's misleading is that the complaint alleges in detail the mechanics by which the system is deficient. So there's two ways, essentially, when you boil it down. One is that DHS can do everything that they're supposed to do and still not complete the process in 10 days. Okay, because it's just their complex is so, their process is so involved with so many different players that it just can't be completed in 10 days. The other way it's deficient is that sometimes the DHS officials don't do what they're supposed to do, and then the process never gets completed. And that's what happened for all three plaintiffs here. It's what happened with five other beneficiaries who are identified in the complaint, and those were items 183 to 187, where the same thing happened. They appealed timely and never had their benefits restored until Legal Aid contacted DHS on their behalf. So we have credibly alleged that the system fails for everybody because of one or two of these kind of deficiencies, and that the only people who ever receive continuing benefits are those that have somebody like an attorney or maybe a caregiver or a case manager who will intervene on their behalf. And that's simply not tolerated by the due process standard. So with regards to those systemic failings, that helps also support standing. Now, of course, all the cases that the state cited where standing, where the plaintiffs didn't have standing, were all ones in which they didn't file suit while they were actually experiencing the harm. Here, both Elder and Dearmore actually experienced the reduction when they filed suit and were only restored afterwards. Now, Mr. Taylor was restored a little bit before he filed suit, but that was only after counsel contacted DHS. So all of the folks were experiencing the harm, or at least the results of the harm, at the time of filing the complaint. And to the judge's positions earlier about this repeating annually, I think it's, Ms. Elder has been part of this program for many years. Ms. Dearmore has been part of this program for many years. It wouldn't be reasonable, particularly at the pleading stage, to assume that they somehow are going to lose their eligibility over the next year and not be subject to reassessment using the same exact system that caused them to receive benefit cuts or become ineligible in the first time. It's going to be the same system, both that's assessing them, and then when they experience adverse actions, which they pled,
Is that in dispute at all, that the system has not been modified, that there haven't been safeguards modifying process and procedure to ensure that notice meets a minimal constitutional standard?
I am not aware of any changes by the state that would go to those issues Your Honor is raising.
Now, this case, as I understand it, this case is at the motion to dismiss stage. Is that accurate?
That's accurate, Your Honor.
Okay, so what kind of discovery would you anticipate taking place if the case were to proceed beyond this stage?
Well, at that point, Your Honor, we have discovery about, you know, what everybody knew and when they knew it and what they did in response to their knowledge, of course. And then we have discovery about whatever changes the system, whatever the specific flaws of the system are. And then we have discovery about, you know, what's happened since we filed. So I think all of those things are fair game for discovery. And Your Honor, I guess Ms. Hodge referred to a policy manual that says that, you know, everybody who appeals who receives AR Choices benefits will have continuing benefits. Again, that doesn't take care of the problem. Everybody already had the right to receive continuing benefits pending appeal so long as you appeal timely. The problem wasn't the time frame solely, as the plaintiff's cases show, because they appealed timely and they never got their benefits restored. So whatever that policy manual change is, and that is a change, doesn't it all go to what the situation was at the time the plaintiffs filed the case, and it also doesn't go to it doesn't undermine the essential allegation that the system is deficient because of the mechanics, not because of the entitlement to the continuing benefits, so to speak.
Mr. DeLayman, I think you misspoke. You said that they never had their benefits restored. Doesn't the record reflect that everyone did eventually have their benefits restored, but only after action on their part or their attorney's part?
Pardon me, Your Honor. So the plaintiffs never had their benefits restored until we got involved.
Exactly.
We believe, pursuant to the deficiencies in the process, that there are other people of which we are not aware that may never have had their benefits reinstated because the mechanics of the process don't work. Your Honors, I guess in sort of closing,
can you cite us to any more specific, to cases more specific to these facts that would indicate that qualified immunity should not protect the defendants in this case? Something that isn't at the high level of generality that the Supreme Court has warned us to avoid?
Certainly. With respect to continuing benefits pending appeal, I mean, I don't think there's, that's just a clearly established principle, not only from Goldberg, but the regulations that require that it be done. So I think the fact that there's a regulation that DHS is subject to certainly establishes the clearly established nature of it, as well as DHS's own policy manuals. In terms of the notice,
Are those materials in the record?
Yes,
citations to those specific regs and policy manual.
Yes, Your Honor, those are all in the brief that show that for continuing benefits. For notice, again, you have the requirement that it has to be specific and clear to the individual. In terms of specific cases, there's a plethora. I'm just dealing in the home and community-based care context. There's the KW case out of Idaho, which is cited in the brief, where they use a budget to determine home and community-based service levels, just like is done here. And there, the Ninth Circuit noted that the notice was deficient because it didn't explain how the state arrived at the budget. And that's exactly one part of the component that we have here. Every other case that's cited, you have even the state's own case. They put forward the unreported Washington State case, Kuehl. Well, in Kuehl, the person got the assessment. They got an informational sheet with the assessment that explained the criteria by which you're placed in each group. They got a sheet that showed the specific factual findings unique to that individual, including levels of detail like the reason your benefits are reduced is because you had an open lesion or you didn't have an open lesion, that level of specificity. So those are just two of the cases. Another is,
for instance, a Ninth Circuit case. Would a case from the Ninth Circuit with fairly analogous facts be adequate notice for states in the Eighth Circuit?
Yes, Your Honor. Again, I understand there are certain circumstances in which that might be debatable, but here it's not. You have not only that case and all of the associated case law and regulations that simply show that there's no way that you can think a notice like that which DHS used here is sufficient. And DHS had a notice case that they lost just a few years ago in the Eastern District, which was Jacobs v. Gillespie, which we also litigated, in which Judge Marshall said, Your notice is deficient. You have to explain the outcome with reference to the assessment system you're using. So DHS doesn't merit any leeway here, especially when it comes to kind of the level of generality. They both knew from existing case law and regulations, as well as from their own experience, that the notice that they gave Ms. Dearmore was wholly deficient. And I guess with that, Your Honors, the thing I would like to draw your attention to, if it hasn't already, is of course this is a remarkably long complaint, but it's filled with dates, documents, reports, meetings, agency processes, all sorts of concrete factual allegations that certainly meet Iqbal's standards for plausibility. And that's the context within which each individual's actions needs to be judged, is that this is a complex process working over the agency over the course of several years, whereby despite having repeated information that they were doing wrong, they continued to flout that. And that's kind of the principle in Kehu, the Sixth Circuit case about qualified immunity, in terms of officials operating a complex system, multiple officials involved, a complex system that is depriving individuals of constitutional rights, where the officials simply choose to do nothing. They don't act. They perpetuate and condone the status quo. And that is the reason that the district court's decision should be affirmed. And I thank Your Honors very kindly for the opportunity to argue.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Hodge? You'll need to unmute.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you for permitting me additional rebuttal. Very quickly, there is no Fourth Amendment exception to qualified immunity. Specificity relates to qualified immunity, which applies to all government officials. And so the lack of cases addressing the specific facts here and the specific legal arguments require qualified immunity for all the appellants. Number two, with respect to the notice and the task and hour spreadsheet, and this goes, Judge Erickson, to your question, that the plaintiffs are not entitled to a United States Supreme Court worthy brief. They're entitled to know what the agency did, be provided with that information, and then be able to object to it at a hearing. The spreadsheet says, these are the issues we assessed, this is the time we allocated, and this mathematical calculation renders the amount of hours you're entitled to. And with respect to the complaint, Mr. DeLieben's argument leaves so much to wonder about, because the appellees rely solely on speculation. They are not entitled to do discovery in order to come up with a complaint sufficient to satisfy constitutional standards. Their complaint doesn't allege plausible violations of the Constitution. If their complaint identifies only 30 individuals, those are the facts that this court takes. And those facts don't bear out a systematic deficiency of a constitutional magnitude.
What about the 30 individuals? And the state's view, that would be like the military saying that's merely collateral damage. It's not worthy of concern. The system works pretty well, and we can't be too concerned about it.
No, Your Honor, I definitely don't want to leave the impression that the state is not concerned about.
That's the impression
about.
Leaving with me, at least. It seems like anything goes in Arkansas.
No, Your Honor, definitely. These interruptions were inadvertent, and we certainly mentioned the numbers because those are the numbers.
What did you do to guarantee that that won't happen again?
The system permits, I want to answer Your Honor's first question about this case being an issue of collateral damage. That is certainly not the state's position. The state's position is that all AR Choices beneficiaries receive notice and they are entitled to a hearing. These interruptions are inadvertent, and what the plaintiff's complaint points out is that some unknown or unnamed official may have inadvertently not moved the process along, but that certainly is not the desire of Secretary Gillespie or any of the appellants in the system. The appellees are entitled to a hearing. The system affords them, if the complaint acknowledges that once they request a hearing within 10 days, they are entitled to a hearing. That is DHS's desire. That is the process that's put into place. Even the complaint acknowledges that some of these appeals can be processed as early, I think the complaint says, as 2 days, or the process can begin as early as 2 days or completed as early as 3 days. And what the Medicaid provisions in CFR, 42 CFR, I believe it's 423, say that appellants just have a right to request a hearing within a reasonable time, not to exceed 90 days. And so that time is designated by DHS as Arkansas's waiver program as 10 days. But what we've acknowledged or what we put forth before the court on page 9 of our reply brief is an adjustment in the policy manual that says benefits continue throughout the administrative appeals process. There's a little bit of a factual nuance before the appellees were required to indicate affirmatively a request to continue benefits. Now, on page 9, that references the adjustment in the policy, which this court can take judicial notice of public records, says that if the appeal is received timely, then benefits automatically continue throughout that process. And so
you are improving the system, I take it?
The system has been approved. Yes, Your Honor. There's been an adjustment in the system.
Thank you for your detailed answers.
Can I ask? I still have another question. It's really about the Jacobs case and what notice that may have given to you about what's required, or to Arkansas, what's required in the provision that's given. And if you read the transcript of Judge Price Marshall's decision, it's pretty detailed. It says what the problem is exactly, what needs to be, that there needs to be some explanation that's intelligible to a person who receives the notice, right? And he goes through and explains why he thought under the prior system there was a problem, right? Now, as he said at the end, he said, I'm going to enter a much more conclusory order. And in fact, the order itself is quite conclusory. So the real meat and potatoes of it is in this transcript. Mr. DeLeven is apparently arguing that this is a case, and this is a case that is binding within the Eastern District of Arkansas, and that gave notice to DHS of what the minimum requirements were. Why is that not true?
For a couple of reasons, and thank you for the question, Judge Erickson. It has to be United States Supreme Court case for 1983 liability.
That doesn't seem quite true, because there is a statute exception as well. And clearly, the circuit court can say, we believe that this is now clearly established going forward, and we bind people all the time. Well, not all the time, but we do occasionally say we find a constitutional violation that was not yet clearly established, but going forward it is, right? So it's not just the Supreme Court.
Well, the Supreme Court held in the Rivas case that it was assuming for the purposes of 1983 that a circuit court decision could establish clearly established law, but this is not even a circuit court case. This is an Eastern District case. So the second point is, even if the court were to consider the Jacobs opinion, it's distinguishable for several reasons. One, it's not a circuit court decision. DHS's position certainly is Supreme Court precedent, but even if the court considered circuit court precedent, this is not a circuit court decision. Judge Marshall was very careful, Judge Erickson, to note that this case, the Jacobs case, was being decided on its own facts. So he was careful to say that this is what I've been presented with in this case, and it's for this case only. The other very distinguishable fact is that was a different system. I think appellees acknowledged that there was a rug formulation and a different algorithm. So to the extent that that would even be precedential, it's not factually similar and it's not presented in the same context as the AR Choices program that's using the ARIA system. The other thing that Judge Marshall said, and we cite this in our briefing to Mr. DeLeven, is that perfection is not required in a Medicaid system, and he recognized that. The other important detail about the Jacobs decision is that there wasn't this detailed task in our spreadsheet. That particular component of the notice provision was not before Judge Marshall. And this is DHS's intent to provide additional information as opposed to conclusory statements like your benefits have changed. You know, this is not like those cases the appellees cite where there's a single sentence that says, here's your notice that your budget has changed. Here's notice that your services have changed based on an assessment, but no assessment is attached. Here, there is an assessment that says, we assessed you in these categories. We believe your need is category 1 through 3. And based on that need, we've afforded you this mathematical calculation of benefits.
But there's just a numeric rubric there. And I believe your briefing says that the nurse is supposed to explain and answer any questions, right? About what that means. Is that really an explanation that anyone can understand or comprehend sufficient to make even a determination whether or not you should appeal?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think in the record, what this court should respectfully consider in the record is that when Ms. Dearmore appealed and when Ms. Elder appealed, I think I'm getting the appellees correct, that they checked the box and said, I am appealing because my benefits are inadequate or they have been reduced. I think their very own statements put this question beyond dispute that they were aware upon having a conversation with the nurse and upon receiving written notice that their benefits had been reduced and their allegation or claim was they are not adequate to cover my needs. That is what due process provides. We could debate, and courts have all over the country, about the specificity of what that notice requires, but the due process clause says she just needs to know what happened, and she needs to be able to lodge a complaint, and she did that. She received the notice, and she said, this is not enough, and I would like an appeal to address this, and she'll be given an opportunity at that point. The Medicaid provisions or statutes allow her to receive record so that she can champion her case in the administrative appeal, but she is not entitled respectfully to that information. She doesn't need that on the front end. She just needs to know what happened and be able to make an objection. And that's what distinguishes this case from those cited in other jurisdictions, is that it's not a summary statement, your benefits have changed, the end. She has been provided with some information to say, this is what happened, and I have an objection. And if we rely on the Goldberg decision, Judge Erickson, this procedure was cited favorably. There, the Supreme Court said that an opportunity for a personal conference combined with written notice was the best way to handle this, to have somebody, a beneficiary, be able to talk to a registered nurse about the assessment and then receive a written copy of that. And then once she received that written copy, be able to communicate to DHS, I recognize my benefits have changed and it's my position that they are not enough. As a matter of law, satisfies due process in this case and requires a reversal and dismissal. I'm happy to answer more questions. I certainly appreciate the court affording me additional time to do so. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Hodge. Thank you also, Mr. DeLeben. We appreciate both counsel's presentations to the court and the arguments this morning. They've been beneficial and helpful in our process of evaluating the case. And we'll continue to review the record and the material submitted, render decision in due course. Counsel may be excused. Thank you.
Thank you.